the fifth kind.
There was this disc that was sitting in the cloud, absolutely steady, dead still, huge. And underneath the disc was a triangle, what looked like a metal triangle, reflecting sunlight, so I assume it was metal. And the triangle was connected to the disc with like a tripod affair to the disc. No sound, no windows, nothing at all. It just sat there in the sky. People have often asked me how big. I'm going to make a judgment call by saying probably the size of a 747 aircraft, which didn't exist at that time, but that's how big this thing was.
Our thanks to Surfshark VPN for sponsoring this video. VPNs, virtual private networks, are a really useful tool for protecting your privacy and securing your personal details online. Surfshark VPN is a service that protects your information by encrypting all the data that you send through the internet, keeping anyone unwanted from seeing it. Along with privacy and security, Surfshark VPN offers the ability to change your location with the click of a button, allowing access to sites, features, and streaming services otherwise restricted to certain locations. Get fully protected. Follow the link in the description, sign up, and use the promo code FIFTHKIND to receive an 85% discount. Plus, you'll get 3 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
Lionel Friedberg has spent his life in film. He's an Emmy Award-winning producer, a director of photography on many major films, a documentary maker with National Geographic, NASA, and the Discovery Channel, among many others, and a New York Times best-selling author. His latest book, Forever in My Veins, How Film Led Me to the Mysterious World of the African Shaman, has just been released and is charting around the world. Lionel, welcome to the Fifth Kind TV.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
It's great to have you with us. Congratulations on your new book, which does what it says on the tin. It leads us from the world of film into the mysterious world of African shamanism. And I want to dive right in to that topic and go right back to the beginning. And I think your earliest encounters with African shamanism were when you were working as a props man in television in what was to become Zambia. It was back in the 1960s. And your job, which you were doing fantastically, had just been reassigned to a local. And this created a bit of a crisis for you. So tell us what happened next and how that led you into this amazing world.
Yes, that's exactly how it happened. I was living in northern Rhodesia at the time, which was a British colony. And Britain was giving all its colonies away. They were all getting independence. And so northern Rhodesia was slated to become Zambia in 1964. I'd been working. This was the first television station in Central Africa. And it was an extraordinary experience because we did programming for local vernacular in vernacular languages for local tribes. And at night, we catered to basically a copper mining white audience. So we lived in many worlds in the station. But when independence came and we became Zambia, the station was nationalized. It was originally privately owned. And when we were nationalized, we all got little pig slips from the government to say, thank you very much, you've done a wonderful job, but bye-bye, in 6 months' time, you have to leave. You've got to give your job over to a local person, which we all totally understood. It made total sense. None of us argued with the concept of that. But my big problem was, what was I going to do now? My dream was always to go to Hollywood and work in this town where I live in now, and make films, because I was a film fanatic, a movie fanatic. And we had a wonderful young guy who worked for us. I was an only child. And when my parents moved up to northern Rhodesia, originally from South Africa, which is where I grew up in the apartheid system, and northern Rhodesia was like a breath of fresh air after apartheid, I can tell you. And then when it became Zambia, I worked in the station, and suddenly we were all out of a job. And I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. So I said to this guy who worked for us at home, a Bemba man, a member of the Bemba ethnic group, I said, David, I really don't know what to do. I don't want to go back to South Africa, which, by the way, had a fairly thriving film industry even at that time. We're talking about 1964 now. I said, I don't really want to do that. What should I do? You know, I really want to go and live in America and work in Hollywood and all that. And he said, you know, he and I often spoke about things. We used to sit outside under the fig tree and the mango tree and talk about photography and whatever else. And he said, I will find someone who may help you. And I said, you know, like whom? And he said, trust me. And I did. I implicitly trusted him. So came the day. There was David and I trundling into the bush in my little blue VW Beetle on this little dirt road. We went to an outskirts outside a town called Ndola, where there was a small a cluster of houses out in the boondocks, of course. And on the edge of this was a single house. And David said, there, that's the place we go to, right there. And park your car right there. And I had no idea who or what we were in for. And he knocked at the door, and this little old woman opened the door, hunched over. It was a piping hot day, and she was covered up in a coat, whatever else. She had a skin pigment problem. She was a member of the Bemba group, but she had a skin pigment problem, so she was an albino. And wrinkled up and, you know, extremely old, and she beckoned us into her little house. She spoke no English whatsoever, and she told us to sit down on the floor, which we did. David next to me, he was going to translate, and me over here. And on the floor was a grass mat, and in the middle of the grass mat was an animal skin bag. I had seen something very similar to this as a child when I was growing up in South Africa, when I was about 7 years old. Because one of my nannies had taken me to visit a friend who had a similar little setup in her room. So when I saw this, I thought, oh, this woman is she's one of those healer type people, you know, which I'd been exposed to as a child. And turns out that's exactly what she was. She was, in Zambia, they call them ngangas. In South Africa, they call them sangomas, which is another word for a traditional healer. These people do many, many things. They diagnose illnesses. They can find missing persons. They can foretell the future. They can prescribe medication. And everything is done. The paradigm in Africa is it's all done with the help of the ancestors, of the ancestral spirits. And her tools, her medium to the ancestors, are what was in this little bag. And what was in the bag were a group of bones and stones and pebbles and little trinkets. And she told me, she picked up the bag, she told me to blow into it, which I did, say my name, which I did, and she sprinkled a little bit of snuff into it. She turned the bag upside down, and then the bag, the bones and stones fell on the grass mat. Now, the way they fall is supposedly influenced by the ancestors, my ancestors, not hers. Her ancestors allow her to speak to my ancestors, who can tell her what the bones are saying to them. That's essentially the idea behind it all. And, you know, the minute this little old lady peered at these bones, the very first thing that happened was that she pulled back as though she was blinded by a light. And she said to David, she sort of covered her eyes and she said, what are these bright lights in my eyes? The minute she said that, I knew that she wasn't fooling. She was for real. I'd better pay attention to what she had to say, because she'd seen the lights in the television station where I was working,
yes,
in the studio. So I thought, you'd better pay attention to what this woman has to say to you. And for the next hour or however long it was, there was this endless amount of information that she gave me. David was trying very, very hard to keep up with her, and I was trying to keep some notes. She told me the most extraordinary things. And every single one of those major events that she foretold came true over the next 60 years. It was absolutely extraordinary how this little old woman in that little hut in Africa basically peered into my future. She foretold, yes, the illness that I eventually developed. here in California. She said, you know, she said all sorts of things. I'll give you just a couple of examples. One of the things she said to David was, you know, and my big question, what I was looking for was an answer to my dilemma. What was I going to do with my future? And the, one of the things she said to David was, he will cross the big water and he will go into that direction. And the direction that she was pointing in was to the north. He will cross the big water that way. And, you know, David is telling me this. I have no idea what it meant, but I'm making a note of all of these things. Plus a lot of other things. She said to him at one point, he will go to a place where there are more lights and he will work with big lights and famous people. She said to him, one day he will go to a world where there is no color. There is only white in that place. You know, I had no idea what this meant. David had no idea what it meant. And I don't even think that she knew what she was seeing in the bones. She was obviously having visions that she fully didn't fully understand. I mean, and, you know, remember, Zambia is a landlocked country. This little woman had probably never been more than 10 miles from her hut. She'd never seen the ocean. She had no idea what the ocean looked like. And yet she tells me all of this stuff.
It's very interesting, that method that she used, this little pouch with bones in it and items. You can go to North America and you'll find the same method used by shamans there in that culture, which is very intriguing. I want to come back a little later to the role that the ancestors play in the Nanga's process. But I know one thing she predicted was really intriguing, and that was she said that you would work with someone who was close to the most evil man in the world.
Yes.
And that was to come true. And I imagine as all these things came true over the decades that followed, it sort of sucked you in and made you realize there's more and more to this shamanism than I thought. Your life has really been a series of amazing adventures, and it must have been a series of moments where you went, wait a minute.
Yes.
As you recognize another one of these prophecies from this old lady had come true. And it's almost as if, Lionel, I think you were destined to write Forever in My Veins, because every time that happened, it really was pulling you back and saying, look at this, remember this.
Yeah.
There's something here. And this is very much part of what you share in the story of Forever in My Veins. There's another beginning moment I'm interested in, which is from the 1970s. You were working on a documentary project with Peter Becker. You were back in South Africa, where you grew up.
Yes.
And I know there was something very significant about that project for you. It took about a year, I think. Tell us what happened.
Well, that was a series on the history, not on the history, but on the cultures, if you like. And basically, to identify to a white audience who their black neighbors were. You know, the writing was on the wall for the government in power at the moment, the Afrikaans nationalist government in power, even during the 70s, even though Nelson Mandela was only released many, many years later and apartheid only ended many, many years later. By the mid-70s, the inner sanctum of the apartheid regime knew that the writing was on the wall. Apartheid could not go on forever. It was time for the white man to get to know his black neighbor. Who were those people? What were all the other tribal groups all about? The white community knew absolutely nothing about this. There was no point of contact whatsoever. There were separate amenities for everything. There were even separate beaches for people. The twain never met. We knew nothing about our black neighbors. And so it was decided that we should do a series identifying and describing the histories and the cultures of some of these major tribal groups in South Africa. And there are 11 official languages in South Africa today, which gives you some idea of how diverse the tribal community is in South Africa, these various national groups. And they all have histories and they all have amazing cultures and so on. So that's what the series was about. And two of the shows, Peter Becker was an anthropologist who had studied African culture for many, many years. He began his life as a school teacher, but he developed this love of anthropology. And he did a lot of research among the tribes. And he was very, very respectful of African religious beliefs and the rituals that they practiced, particularly rituals of transcending from childhood to adulthood. Each tribe has different rituals that one goes through, and also this whole idea of the ancestral role in society, which is there's no direct communication with the supreme being. They all believe in that. But the only way to reach that is through the ancestors. You talk to your ancestors. Your ancestors can then connect you with Nkosi Nkulu or whatever the tribal group is, the name for God. You don't pray directly to God. Unless, of course, you practice Christianity, which many, many people in South Africa do. In fact, one of the largest church groups in the world is the Zion Christian Church based in South Africa that has a membership of something like 5 million people. And it's based on Christianity entirely, but in the ethnic communities, in the tribal areas, it's still very much an animistic culture, and it's a patriarchal culture, and so everything is done through the ancestors. So what we wanted to do was to show all this and depict all this, and the one of the most interesting tribal groups in the country are called the Venda, V-E-N-D-A. They speak a language that is not related to any of the other languages spoken in South Africa. The other two main language groups are kind of interrelated and connected with one another, like Swazi and Zulu are part of the Nguni group, the Sotho and Tswana is part of the Sotho group, and so on and so forth. But the Venda are unique. They speak a language that obviously comes from somewhere else in Africa. Yes. These are probably people who migrated south and settled in that part of South Africa from the north somewhere, you know, but no one really knows their history. And they have a tradition that every 5 years they pay homage to the Great Spirit, their great ancestor, if you like, who supposedly lives in a sacred lake in a valley in Vendaland. Vendaland is not called that anymore, but those days it was. And it's a sacred territory. Nobody goes there. And we were very fortunate to just fall into that a time span where they were about to undertake this ceremony. And I thought, oh God, you know, this has got to go in the show. And what they do is they thank the ancestor, the great spirit of the ancestor of the tribe, by pouring homemade beer and other commodities into the lake. There's chanting, there's drumming, they wear their traditional clothing, you know, grass skirts, beads. It's very colorful. And on the appointed day, we go down to the lake, Peter Becker, myself, the crew, everybody else. And the man who was going to officiate at this ceremony was a very, very old man who the headman of this particular village told us lives in the middle of the mountains, and he will be fetched and he will be brought down. You know, in Africa, you don't really ever know what's going to happen. There's always a mystery behind a mystery. You know, they'll say, yeah, you know, it's like beyond the horizon or beyond the tree. There's no such thing as an exact time. Things just happen. Yes. It's extraordinary. I mean, it's just wonderful in so many ways. And so we're set up to do this filming. And one of the things we had to do when we reached the lake was to remove our shoes. Like the biblical commandment to Moses, remove the shoes from off thy feet, from the land upon which thou standest is holy ground. And of course, the Hindus also practice the same thing, as do the Muslims. You don't wear shoes on holy ground. So we removed our shoes. Now, the area around the lake is very rocky, lots of thorns and lots of things that can prick and bump and hurt and whatever else. And eventually, this old man arrives on the arms of two young men, just arriving through the bush, withered and ancient. Through our fixer, or our interpreter, if you like, who was with us at the lake, Peter, when he met this man, he suddenly felt very, very humbled by this man, because Peter was very, very respectful of African culture. And he said to our fixer, ask this man if he knows how old he is. And, you know, some questions were asked and the old man answered. And Peter said, what does he remember as a child? Anyway, the sort of things he told us were he was clearly over 100 years old. He was a very, very old man. And the scene was that he would go to the edge of the lake. He would start doing his incantations and chantings towards the lake itself. Drumming was going on either side. And then two other people, also in tribal costume, were pouring beer into the lake. He's now, you know, connecting with the ancestor of the tribe. And as Peter was getting into position in front of the camera, so the camera is here, The old man is in the background, and Peter was going to be in between that and me to explain what is going on. He stubbed his toe and was sort of bouncing around. Ouch, ouch, ouch. And of course, one of the sound men, the assistant, started to giggle. Now, you don't behave that way because, you know, this is sacred. This is sacred territory. You don't do that. But you know what it's like when someone starts to giggle and laugh. It's infectious. It goes around the room very, very quickly. So we all started, you know, stifling our laughter. It was very, very funny. We'd never seen Peter bouncing around like this, you know, ouch, 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 on one leg. And as our laughter could be heard by some of the people involved in the ceremony, but not this old guy, because he couldn't possibly have heard us. Nevertheless, he was aware of what was going on, because whilst he was doing this chanting towards the lake, he stopped and he turned around and looked at us.
Oh.
At that very moment, remember, we're running film and we're running a separate tape deck, running magnetic tape, recording the sound, and these two devices are connected together. Lots of electronics and things can go wrong, but everything is going smoothly. It's all happening. The minute this old man turned around to look at us, everything stopped working. The camera jammed, the tape recorder stopped working, everything died. I went into panic stations, as did Peter. The laughing stopped instantly. I said to my sound man, "What's going on?" He had no idea. Thank goodness we had, you know, a little technical boffin with us, and out he comes with his voltmeter, measuring the lines. Everything's got power in it. The camera's got power. The tape deck has power. Peter's microphone has power, but nothing is working. It was very clear to both Peter and I that something was at play here that we didn't understand. There was something supernatural happening that was influencing the scene. It was. No question about it.
Yeah. And there are so many. I just want to pick up on a number of elements you mentioned there, because there are so many interconnecting elements so far in the story, because first of all, we're going to come back later to the unusual longevity of this holy man.
Yes.
We'll come back to that later because that's quite relevant. And then electromagnetics and how that relates to the way that this man is operating, what he's able to do. The connection with the ancestors is really interesting. I actually think the beer pouring, beer crops up in so many ancestral narratives about how we began as human beings. Beer is right in the middle of those stories. Mm. And then the aspect of connecting with ancestors, you mentioned that in a lot of African countries, you have Christianity existing alongside indigenous narratives and spiritual practices. But right in the roots of Christianity, Christianity was a kaleidoscope of beliefs right at the beginning, and there are some hints at aspects that kind of got edited out as orthodoxy narrowed down, and one of them has to do with ancestors. There's an amazing verse you probably know in the book of Hebrews that says, "Since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us." And the picture in that verse is that those who have gone before us have not gone before us. They surround us, and they are very interested in the lives we lead. Mm. And that was a truth that the writer of that Christian book knew, that perhaps in the West we've forgotten, but it seems very, very connected with African shamanic practice.
No doubt. Well, I mean, look, even Jesus said himself, did he not? He said, "Many mansions hath my Father's house." Well, that means that there are many, many layers and levels and realms. It's not you're not just as we see it. There are many, many dimensions to the spiritual world. I've interpreted it that way. I don't think that he's referring to, I think that Christ was probably one of the most enlightened individuals, and we have not fully interpreted what he meant in so much of what he said, because some of it was so unbelievably profound and relevant today as we find out about things like this, like the kind of thing that I'm describing. We've never really understood it because the early translators or whatever, or writers of the biblical books, you know, didn't get it all. And of course, the Bible, let's just talk about that for a second, has been redacted and translated so many times that we have lost so much of the essence of what was really meant, particularly when you go back to the Old Testament. But I think it pertains to the New Testament as well. And
yes,
I think that there are indications in there, you know, that there's more to this than we tend to normally think of. Life, the world, the universe is an amazing place, and there are many levels and realms that exist. And perhaps it was to the advantage of the church to confine it and, you know, contain it and compartmentalize it and keep it at a smaller level. But really, I think if we really got to the original text of the Bible, it would open up a whole new understanding to us of what's really going on, and the awesome vastness of it all, and the mystery of it all. You know.
Yes, you are absolutely speaking my language, Lionel. My most recent two books are exactly about that.
Oh,
going
really?
Back to the original languages and saying, "Hold on, there's a much bigger pitch here. There's far more going on here than we've realized."
Absolutely.
I want to come back to your encounters, because you've encountered a number of very interesting Sangomas, Nangas through the years. And often when they meet you, they will say, "You have an elephant with you. There's an elephant spirit with you." They pick up on this. So what's the story behind that?
I'll tell you, because that was one of the most extraordinary things that this little old woman had told me. And I wish I knew her name. I don't even know her name. But this little old lady who had now had such a place in my life, one of the things she said was, "Beware of the bush, because one day there will be a great beast, and that great beast may kill you." I had no idea. It sounded scary, very scary. I mean, what is she talking about? You know, I had no idea. I'm going to go back in time to the year 1967, where I decided to, as a cameraman, I took on a job to cover a safari for three very wealthy Americans who flew out from California to Mozambique to go on a hunting safari. The man who called me was a Swedish producer who, you know, often did films and got things like that organized for people. And he calls me up and he said, "There's a guy coming out with two friends and they're going on safari in Mozambique and they want a film made, coverage made of their safari. Are you interested? Would you go along? Would you want to do that?" I said yes, not because for any other reason other than the fact that hunting and killing wild animals has never made any sense to me whatsoever. I just don't understand what the kicks in, what people get out of that. Where is the fun in that? I don't understand. So I thought, well, if you go along on this safari, which is obviously well-funded, it's going to be very well organized. Let's see what are these guys, what do they get out of this? Killing wild, innocent wild animals. For what? For trophies to take home and put on their walls? You know, what is it all about? It doesn't make any sense to me at all. So I took the job. And I flew from Johannesburg to what was then known as Lorenzo Marques, today called Maputo. At that time, Mozambique was a province of Portugal. Today, it is independent, of course. And then from there, I flew to Beira, met these guys when they arrived from their flight from the States. And in we go to the bush. And they all had licenses. There was a huge hunting concession in the middle of the country. Now, Mozambique was pretty undeveloped at that time. Wildlife thrived everywhere. It was honestly, it was like the Garden of Eden in many regions in Mozambique. It was absolutely wonderful. Since then, wars and civil dissent and, you know, all kinds of unrest and all the rest of it has basically decimated wildlife in many parts of Mozambique, as it has in so many parts of Africa, sadly. But those days, wildlife was everywhere. So we go to this hunting concession, which is huge. And all of these guys have permission to shoot, you know, like two buffalo, a number of zebra, the other. They could each shoot one elephant. And we had two white hunters who led the expedition, basically to tell these three guys, you know, what to shoot and where to go and whatever else. Two people who were head of the safari company that operated this concession, this hunting concession. Two very nice guys. They were all extremely nice people, but, you know, every night I would try and get them to convince me that what they were doing was okay, you know. And of course, they would always dismiss my arguments. People have been doing this for millions of years. Forget about it. You know, people have been killing for, you know, stop being such a wimp. You know, so what could I do? I had to cover this carnage, and it really was carnage. One day came the turn for this one white hunter to shoot his elephant. And one of the white hunters, one of the leaders of the expedition, picked one out, an old bull, and said, that one on the edge of the herd, that's the guy that you must aim for. But, you know, for God's sake, don't miss. Try and hit him right between the eyes, because that's a clean kill. Anyway, I set up my camera right behind him. Next to me is one of the trackers who was assigned to me to carry my battery. It was a big, heavy-duty, wet-cell battery, almost the size that you have in a car today. You know, those days, everything was heavy. And I have a film camera, 16-millimeter Ariflex, on my shoulder with a big brace. You know, everything weighed a ton those days, unlike today's video cameras, or where you can make up, you know.
You today, couldn't run with them.
All you do is this today, you know. Anyway, so yeah, so I set up behind the hunter, the American, and he takes aim, and he shoots, and he misses. And the herd stampeded. They went wild because they knew what a gunshot meant. They'd been, you know, they knew what hunting was all about. And they stampeded. They fled in every direction, except for a lone cow, a single female elephant in the middle of the herd. She had a baby at her feet next to her. And she knew the minute she heard the gunshot, she knew that her baby might be in danger. And she looked at the hunter, it was in front of me, and she decided to charge him because she thought her baby was in danger. So he's in front of me. He tries to take aim to shoot her, and the white hunter, the leader behind me, says, no, 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 don't shoot her. And, you know, so he runs out of shot, and I'm alone, completely frozen in place because I can't move, with a stampeding elephant getting bigger and bigger and bigger in my frame. The guy next to me carrying my battery in Portuguese is yelling, come on, come on, come on, come on, let's go. I couldn't move. I could not move. And when the elephant, and I'm not exaggerating, the elephant must have been about 6 to 8 feet away from me before the white hunter decided that he had no option, but he had to shoot. He had to shoot her, which he did. And he got her right between the eyes. And she stopped dead, and she looked at me. I made a connection with her. The minute this elephant looked at me, I made a connection. I feel she knew I was not the one responsible for threatening her baby or her child or who had just shot her. When we made this connection, she fell down onto her front legs, slowly fell on her side, her eyes glazed over, and she died. My heart was pounding. What was initially terror for me now was absolute sadness. I felt absolute remorse, and I had filmed all of this. The camera had never stopped running for a moment. And I felt that when she fell over like that and her eyes were locked with mine, we had made a connection. Something mysterious had happened. I did not understand what, but I did feel that something had happened. We had made this connection with one another. That evening, go to this. That evening at base camp, you know, the alcohol is flowing and all of these guys are talking about the day's events. And, you know, the hunter who missed, you know, he was talking about getting an elephant another day and whatever else. And I went to sit by myself on the side of this room in this thatched building where which was our base camp. And it suddenly dawned on me. My life could have ended that very day had that car not been shot, because she was stampeding. She was trying to protect her child, and she was killed right in front of me, and we made a connection. I felt that we were now connected. Our spirits were connected. And this was foretold by that little old woman. This is the great beast that may kill me in the bush. She saw this. Now, let's put that aside. On many, many occasions in later years, during the making of the Tribal series, and a lot later when I was living in the States and I developed a very, very serious kidney condition. And I went back to Africa many times and met many shamans, sangomas. Every time they threw the bones, without fail, one of the first things they would always ask me was, what is this elephant that's with you? They could see in their bones that somehow there was this, the word is Ndlovu, which is the Zulu word for elephant. What is this Ndlovu? you've got with you. And was I going to tell and admit that I think that that elephant spirit has been with me ever since? No, I wouldn't confess to that. But I know that that is what has happened. And I kind of think in some mysterious, unfathomable, amazing way that makes me feel unbelievably humble, that that animal spirit has been protecting me over the years.
Yes. And I know it's impacted your life in other ways. We hear a lot from people in the comments when we publish our videos who have experiences that seem to suggest we really are all connected with each other, with other animals, with the planet, with the cosmos in an amazing, mystifying way. And I know that was part of the impact on you of that experience. How has it affected how you've lived your life? I know you're a vegan, but are there other ways in which this amazing sense of connection has altered how you live?
Well, first of all, what I will admit to is that I have an incredible degree of respect for the animal kingdom. And I worked on a number of films that have science documentaries. I did a wonderful series with National Geographic called The Shape of Life, which was basically how nature designs body plans. You know, what makes a worm a worm? Mm. What makes a mammal have a skeleton? You know, how does nature come up with those ideas for the architecture of life? And many, many other subjects. And I did a show many years ago here for PBS, which is the public broadcasting system here in the States, quality programming. And this was a film about dinosaurs. It was before Jurassic Park came out. And it was called The Great Dinosaur Hunt, and it was about basically looking at dinosaur fossils. What can they tell us about the ancient world? So I have this. I've done a lot of scientific work with the animal kingdom, you know. And then I did a series for Animal Planet called Growing Up, which was all about little baby animals that had either lost their mothers, and that had to be hand reared by humans for various reasons. Either the mother had died, or had rejected the baby for various reasons, and on and on and on. So other than pure science, I have a huge amount of respect for the animal kingdom, because I think we are all connected. The mere fact that we are more intelligent and that we are the dominating species does not give us the right to behave the way we do. And one of the reasons why I became vegan is because I don't think it's right to even eat them. And when I look at the industrialized way we farm animals today, that they are pure commodities, and they are not feeling, sentient, sensitive beings, which they all are, I just think it is absolutely horrific. I want no part of that. I can't do that. And so that's one of the things that drove me to being a vegan. But we are all connected. And, you know, the last page of my book, I end the book by saying, I see life as a sort of bumper car ride. You know the little bumper cars? I don't know if you have it in Australia. I know you have it in the UK. We have it here. I'm sure you do. Little bumper cars at the fairground. And at the back of these little bumper cars, where people go around bumping into one another, there's a pole that connects to the power source, which is a grid above the ride, you know, and that's where the power comes from. And I think that's the sort of analogy I use, the symbol, if you like.
Yes. I think
all are connected to a field just like those bumper cars. And I'm going to quote my book, whether we're a person or a pony or a petunia, we are all connected to that field. We're all connected to that grid. We are all interlinked. We are all on a journey. And let's have a little more respect for one another, whether we're human or not. Let's extend that. You know, we live in a very anthropocentric world. And I think we've got to get beyond that, because one of the things I think that's holding us back as a species, because I think ultimately we're destined to become star travelers, and the time will come when we will go to other parts of the universe. We will do this. But until we learn to respect all forms of life, you know, we are going to be mired in warfare and in all the bad things that are holding us back from our spiritual journey. We're on a journey where we need to ascend to the next realm, the next level. We need to go to another level of consciousness. And we can't do that with the way we treat the rest of the of life, I think.
I agree. That's a great segue to the next topic, which touches on something that happened to you when you were doing a film project in Saskatchewan.
Yes.
This is in 1966, and you were doing a documentary about one thing. I think it was to do with pioneering and housing or something like that, and then something totally not to do with that happened right when you were filming. Tell us about that.
We were doing a documentary. I was living in Canada at the time, and we were working for the National Film Board, doing a documentary about the history of housing. Now, you know, most of the urban areas of Canada, of course, are strung along, you know, the edge of the United States border. But then there are little communities elsewhere. I mean, Canada is absolutely a huge, huge country. And so little communities develop here and there. So the film was about how and why urban areas develop, usually around a mine or around some kind of agricultural activity or whatever. And so we were in Saskatchewan. A town was growing around a potash plant where they were mining potash. Now, I have to be ashamed to say that I don't fully remember what potash is, but it's mined from the ground, and I think it's used in fertilizer. It's a white substance. It comes out, looks like lime. And as they dig it, it makes lots of white dust. And so we had to do a sequence at this potash plant. And then we were going to film in this little town growing up next to it for the rest of the day. And it was a very small crew, and we stayed at a motel. And Saskatchewan is a very, very flat province. So we were staying at a motel probably 30 or 40 miles away from the plant. And the next morning we, you know, get into our, those of station wagons. We were driving in a station wagon towards the plant. And you could see this cloud of white dust up there on the horizon. And as we got to when we got to the plant, the guy at the gate said to us, you know, you guys get down to the plant because there's something up in that cloud. So the director said, what? You know, what is it? And he said, we don't know, but there's something in that cloud up there. We went down to the parking lot. The director went and met the manager of the plant, goes inside to go and discuss the day's filming. But I was at the car. I set up the camera and I put on the longest lens we had. I don't remember the exact focal length. It probably must have been about a 300 millimeter lens. And a couple of guys sauntered over to me in the lot and said, yeah, there's something up there. We've seen it. And I said, like, what does it look like? They couldn't describe it. And I said, all right, well. So I was looking through the camera up at the cloud, couldn't see a thing. And it was a very, very quiet day. But then a little breeze came up. And as this breeze came up, the cloud sort of opened up a little bit. And my word, inside this cloud was a glint of metal. And I thought, you're right, there is something in there. And I focused up on it, and this breeze continued, and it eventually cleared, and there was this disc that was sitting in the cloud, absolutely steady, dead still, huge. And underneath the disc was a triangle, what looked like a metal triangle. Anyway, it was kicking off sunlight, reflecting sunlight, so I assume it was metal. And the triangle was connected to the disc with like a tripod affair to the disc. No sound, no windows, nothing at all. It just sat there in the sky. People have often asked me how big. I'm going to make a judgment call by saying probably the size of a 747 aircraft, which didn't exist at that time. But that's how big this thing was. And the minute it cleared and I saw it, I turned on the camera and started running film on it. I had always wanted to see a UFO. I was a UFO fanatic ever since I was a child. I read George Adamski's book when it came out as in the 50s. I had dreams about that. And then I saw The War of the Worlds in 1953, and I said, I want to meet a Martian, you know. So I was totally open to and wanted eventually to have an experience that similar to this. But, you know, when it does happen, you kind of are taken aback because it's nothing like you think it's going to be. And but this was definitely not man-made. That was for sure. So we ran film. I ran film. And after a while, it got covered up again. I stopped running. I must have run about 150 feet of film. And that's the equivalent to, you know, a few minutes of screen time. Anyway, We had work to do. The rest of the day was spent at the plant. We photographed the digging of the mining of the potash, the town growing up. And that night I sent the film back to Montreal by rail. I used to go down to the nearest railhead and send it back to the lab in Montreal. And I made a note on the can of that particular piece of film: please hold for our return. You know, all the other cans had specific lists of what we'd shot with a camera sheet. You know, identifying towns, houses, bulldozers, whatever else. Except this one, I couldn't describe what it was. I just said, hold for our arrival. So weeks go by, and eventually we return to Montreal, and now it's time to go and look at our rushes, the dailies of what we'd shot on this trip. And, you know, it took a couple of hours to unravel all this film of all these boring little towns and things that we'd shot. And at the end of that, the projectionist said, should I run this piece, you know, that you have here that says hold for arrival? So, yeah, put it on, please. The director was there. The other member of the crew was there. The head of the camera department was there. And a couple of other people, I don't remember. I'm talking about 1966 now. I don't remember too many details of who was in the audience. But when we saw this on the screen, big, this was clearly something very, very strange. And the head of the camera department said, wow, you know, maybe we should send that to the States because they've got a program going there called Project Blue Book, I think. Let's find out where they are. Let's send them the footage and see what they think of it. We sent them the original footage. We didn't make a copy.
Oh.
And the reason is that those days when we shot film, you had an option of shooting on two different kinds of film stock. You could shoot negative, from which you made a print, or you could shoot reversal, which was a positive. You get a positive image. It was called Kodachrome. Kodachrome had a wonderful reversal film, it was called. So what comes out of the camera, you could look at or make a slide out of or make a movie out of and project. And so we didn't bother to make a copy of it. And the head of the lady who ran the camera department, she packaged it up and had it couriered to Project Blue Book in, I think it was Dayton, Ohio, at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base.
Wright-Patterson.
Yeah. And I know that because she told me that they signed for it. They received the film. And, you know, end of story. Other things happened. I worked on another little documentary. And then one day I went into the camera department and I said, hey, Frankie, did we ever hear back from those folks in the States about that thing that we shot in Saskatchewan? And she said, no, I'll call them, which she did. They denied receiving it. Their answer to her was, what film? You know, no, we didn't get that film.
Yeah.
We know that.
Even though they'd signed for it.
Even though they'd signed for it, yeah. They denied outright receiving the film. So...
This was really right in the thick of that long period of silence, denial, non-disclosure, cover-ups, very frustrating. I'm thankful things look like they're beginning to shift a little bit.
I think disclosure may be getting closer all the time. I really do think so, particularly with the recent incident with the USS Nimitz off San Diego. I mean, that footage was extraordinary.
That's right.
And was on
and then
the network.
Yeah. We'll have some disclosures later this year with the Senate intelligence briefing. So we'll be ready for that and see what comes.
I hope so. And I hope Biden does something about unlocking some of the stuff. But, you know, the Russians have information. I'm sure the Chinese have information. I know Brits. The Brits certainly do. The French must have, you know.
That's right. I think America is trailing behind in the disclosure process. More has been declassified by other countries, for sure. I wanted to ask if you heard anything in your travels among the Nangas and the Sangomas that relate to what might be happening in our airspace, that might relate to our cosmic neighbors. Do they talk about these phenomena at all?
Well, one of the most, he wasn't in my series, but one of the most well-known Sangomas in South Africa was a man by the name of Credo Mutwa. And Credo Mutwa is world-renowned as an author. He wrote an incredible history of his people, the Zulu people, called Indaba, My Children. Indaba is a Zulu word which means meeting, have a meeting. Let's sit down and have a meeting. Indaba, My Children, which he wrote decades ago. And in an interview, which I think I actually saw on either YouTube or the Gaia channel here in the States, he clearly says in it, you know, that and he's written about this as well. He said, when I was a child, I encountered a UFO, and he grew up in the northern part of South Africa. He said he was a herds boy, as most little guys are when they grow up in tribal areas. You know, they take care of their fathers and the tribe's cattle. That's what he did. And he must have been about 7 or 8 years old. And he said that he encountered these little people. And I think he was describing either a gray or a white.
Yes.
Hovering above the ground. And they took him inside their ship. And he said, and that's basically, I have no idea how long I was inside there. They examined me. I wasn't frightened. And he said, you know, after that, I developed this power of mine to be a Sangoma. That gave me my powers. Yeah, I met a child at a conference 2 years ago who was one of maybe 30 or 40 children in Zimbabwe. This might have been about maybe 10 or 15 years ago, at a school in Zimbabwe, out in the middle of nowhere, a private school, where a lot of children were sent to boarding school. And one day, a UFO came down into the bush next to the school. And it was playtime, and all the kids said, oh, you know, started running to go and investigate what this, whatever it was.
Is this aerial school you're telling us about?
I think I'm not quite sure.
Rua?
Yeah, I think it is. Yes. I think it's a very famous case. The BBC, the BBC was there at the time because Zimbabwe, it was early days. And then the BBC, before they got kicked out by Robert Mugabe, were covering stuff. And they flew over and interviewed all these children.
And John Mack also, I think, went and spoke to the students as well to ask them what they'd seen.
I believe so, yes. So I was at a conference and I met one of these, she's now a young lady, but that time she was a child, a young girl. And she told me that she was one of the many children who actually ran across over the fence into the bush to go and look for this object. And that she was coming around a corner and she said to me, as I came around the corner, there were these two beings in front of me. They were hovering. They weren't touching the ground. She was almost describing again what many people describe as grays or maybe whites, these tall whites, but with the elongated dark eyes. Personally, I think that those might be hybrid creatures, or these are not the masterminds behind the mission. I think they're probably either robotic or hybrid.
Yeah.
With some degree of a combination of either robotic and real.
Yes.
Who knows?
But she said, workers.
Yeah, maybe. Like, and she said, I saw them and I stopped dead in my tracks. And she said, I looked into the eyes of this one, and as I looked into his eyes, I couldn't move. And I felt as though they were downloading information into my eyesight, into my brain, because I was rooted to the spot. And she said, I have no idea how long I was there, but when it was finished, they just turned and went. And she said, I had this headache because I knew I had been fed a lot of information. This is how she described it to me when she was a child. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the extraordinary thing, that a lot of those children, many, many years later, beyond their teenage years, early adults, started recording this event, and they started drawing this event. And they were now living in very different parts of the world. Some people had gone overseas. Some people were still living in Zimbabwe. And a lot of the drawings and the stories were almost exactly the same. This girl, I said to her, what do you think it was telling you? And she said, what it told me, and I know it's true because all my drawings and my dreams have been the same thing, that we are destroying our world. We are destroying nature. And we must stop doing that, because if we don't, we will not have a world to live in anymore. And I know that that's the message I got. Now, if you think about it, why would an event like that happen in the middle of nowhere in the wilds of Africa? This is the kind of thing that should happen on Fifth Avenue or on the lawns of the White House or in Trafalgar Square. That's the message that we need. But, you know, we're hostile creatures.
That's right. We would shoot them down if they tried to arrive there.
Exactly. We'd either arrest them or blow them to pieces. So maybe they were trying to get the message through to us through these children. I think that that's what happened. It's an environmental message. It's a message of compassion and a message of peace. You know, Travis Walton, who you no doubt know, who was taken aboard a UFO in Arizona many, many years ago when he was a lumberjack, basically, you know, cutting down trees. Although they made a film which made it look like a horror story, it made it look like it was a very, very antagonistic, dark story, he said, that's not really what happened at all. He said, I went to investigate this craft in Arizona, this man. We were working in the forest. We had to thin out the trees, and we saw this disc, and I went up to it, and his buddies were in a truck, and they said, don't go there. You don't know what it is, you know. But he was brave enough to do that, you know, gung-ho, and he goes there, and he said, this beam came out, and I got zapped by the beam, and the next thing he woke up, and he was inside the craft, and there were all these faces of these alien creatures looking over him, and he said, they weren't antagonistic. They weren't threatening me at all. He said, I believe they actually saved my life, because what was probably really happening was as I approached the craft wanted to move away, but this energy beam came out and hit me, and my heart may have stopped beating, and they were healing me. He says, that's probably what was happening. They were being benevolent towards me, not hostile.
That is really interesting, because I hear from a lot of people who contact me who've had close encounters, and sometimes the after effect of those close encounters is rather like with Credo Mutua. They start receiving information, or like the girl at Rua School in Zimbabwe, they start receiving information, they experience precognition, they experience remote viewing, and then others experience physical healing, or they get advice on how to get healing as something they're suffering with. So there's a very interesting wider phenomenon happening there, and a knowledge of us, how our bodies work and who we are.
Yes.
And I want to bridge from that into your experiences of healing, because the healing modalities that the Nangas practice are very different from what we do in our conventional Western medicine. Yes. And you have a story about a friend of yours. I know you have a story of your own relating to your kidney condition.
Yes.
There's a friend of yours you took who was suffering from cancer. And can you tell us what happened when those encounters happened? What is the approach to healing and to health that is so different that comes from these African shamans?
Well, once again, the way they would do their diagnosis, if you like, or their prognosis, or identify what's wrong with you, with the patient, is to consult the bones, because it's the ancestors who tell them what the problem is. And then the ancestors will give them guidance as to what kind of muti, the word for medicine, among all these people, the Sangomas, Ngangas, back in that part of the world, Southern Africa, is muti. Muti is anything that heals. And the muti that they use comes from the natural world. It's herbs, it's leaves, it's grasses. It comes from nature. And a lot of these people go out and collect it themselves, bark and berries and roots and whatever else, make compound their own substances, grind it up, and give people the stuff, not necessarily always to drink as you would get from a pharmacy, but sometimes to use as a ritual in a bath. One of the things, for example, that was prescribed to me when my kidney disease was diagnosed by a Sangoma was that I need to take this particular powder that had a connection because of the spirit of the trees that it came from. That tree was able to be in communication with the spiritual realm, therefore with my ancestors. My ancestors would go into that, and I needed to do a ritual bath, sprinkle it into the bath once a week, completely submerge myself in this bath and just lay there and let the healing work, let the ancestors do the work, and then let the water out. Don't look back. Let all the darkness and the illness flow out. Don't look back. Leave and get on with your life. I still do that once every week. So the paradigm is completely different. However, there are other methods that they use. And now I'm going to talk about this one particular process that I experienced, and that is when I went back to Africa on one of my trips was I was diagnosed by this man, and he said, you know, you really have a very serious condition. He didn't mention what it was. This was in Swaziland, or what is now Eswatini, in Swaziland. And he said, you need a very, very powerful man to heal you of this. He didn't say heal me as much as he said to rid you of this illness, to get rid of it, is the terminology. And it was arranged that I would go and meet this other person at a little compound way up there in the mountains on a particular night. And I was driven there with a friend of mine that I was with, who's a surgeon from here, from California, originally also from South Africa. And he studies the ways of the shamans in South Africa. He's been studying them for years. And a few other people. And anyway, we went to this compound, a series of huts in this mountain range, spectacular scenery, way up, overlooking Mozambique. You have South Africa, then you have Swaziland, and then you have Mozambique. So this was on the edge of Swaziland, overlooking Mozambique, green, marvelous countryside. And when we arrived, it was about 5 o'clock in the evening, I heard this drumming going on, and I was shown into a very large circular hut, which had a thatched roof, a single pole in the middle holding up the roof, and around inside this hut were a lot of women. I would say maybe 30 women, only females, drumming, thin little drums, putting out a high-pitched sound, dun, 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 not big, thick, big drums, but little, smaller ones, and trilling. It was a little unnerving. There was a fire next to the pole in the middle of the hut, and I was told by two young guys who showed me in there, and they said, the Ngangal here will be with you in a minute, but you must get undressed and sit here by the fire. Undressed? Yeah. They have to strip down. I've got all these women around me. Some of them have got babies on their backs and their children. I threw everything to the wind and I said, whatever it takes, I'll do it. So I stripped down to my underwear, just a pair of underpants, and sat there in the middle of the hut with this drumming going on, shaking every bone in my body, going right into my marrow. It was an extraordinary experience. And the fire waiting, and it felt like forever I was waiting for something to happen. And then eventually this man arrived. He was in his tribal regalia, lots of beads, a skirt, little cocoon rattles tied around his ankles. And he arrived at the other end of the hut with his arms spread out like this and shouted, "Yeah!" Well, I was terrified. It was straight out of an Indiana Jones movie. He dropped down onto his hands and feet, onto his hands and knees, and on all fours, he started to approach me, walking like a hyena, with his back arched up like this. It reminded me of a hyena. And his eyes were bloodshot, and he made no sound except a grunting noise. It was pretty terrifying. But I knew that something extraordinary was going to happen that night, and I just let it play out, you know. He started to smell me all the way from my feet, up my legs, all the way up to my torso. And when he got to the area of my left kidney, now I had developed a serious chronic kidney condition affecting both of my kidneys. They were both failing big time. The minute he got to my left kidney, he started to heave as though he wanted to vomit. And he starts to retch, and these two young guys run out with a barrel. And he vomited this ghastly, slimy, yellowy material into the barrel, not saying anything to me, and then started to smell me all the way up to my head. When he was here, smelling into my ears, it was frightening. And then he started to smell me down the right side. And when he got to the right-hand side of my body, to the where the kidney is, he starts to heave again, vomiting. And he vomited into the barrel. And all the way down to my feet. And then at the end of all of this, he stood up and folded his arms and looked down at me with his big bloodshot eyes and made a number of pronouncements, which were only explained and translated to me later because I didn't know what he was talking about. We can talk about what he said later on. But anyway, must have been around about 10, 11 o'clock at night. It all came to an end. Everybody dispersed. He left the hut. I was allowed to get dressed. And we drove back to where we were staying. I had no idea what happened, but I knew that something very profound had happened to me. The next day, I felt as though something had been removed from my being. I don't know what it was. One of the things that apparently he told me, which was translated to me later, was that I needed to get a cane, a walking stick, and that every time I go walking, I must think of my grandfather, my paternal grandfather, whom I had never met, because my father was originally from Latvia, and I never met his father, and that it was my paternal grandfather who would take care of me if I take this cane wherever I went. He would take care of me and help me to heal, and that I would be, this cane would represent him, and that I would be walking with him every time I go out. Now, it sounds absolutely insane and crazy. I go nowhere if I go for a long walk or I go into the Mojave Desert, which I do frequently. That cane goes with me. And it's almost as though I had an exorcism that night. That man purged me of something. Now, I tell you this, my nephrologist, who's probably one of the best nephrologists here in LA, he said to me when I developed this illness 30 years ago, he said, you know, within 10 years, you're going to be on dialysis or you'll be dead, one of the two. I don't know which will come first, but you will. It's now been 30 years, and I think all of this has played a role in keeping me alive. That particular event, I think, played a significant role. In addition to the Western allopathic medication that I have been taking, but yes. I think all of this has played a part. And it's not just a mental belief that I have nurtured in order to convince myself that I'm getting better. I know that healing has happened from the Sangomas in their little huts in the wilds of Africa. They have helped me.
And how do you, let me ask a very reductive Western question. What in the world do you think was going on? There were so many modalities being used there. Yeah. What do you think it was? An entity removal? Do you think it was an exorcism? Were the vibrations of the drumming part of that? Do you believe the phenomena the way they're described to you by the Sangomas, or do you let it be a mystery?
I have to tell you, Paul, I'd like to keep it a mystery, but I honestly do believe that he purged me of some sort of negative energy that was within me. And, you know, everything is about negative energy. It's all about that. Illness, you know, it's all about negativity. It's about something going wrong, and that means there's something negative at play. And whatever that mechanism or that force or that power or that whatever it is might be, if it's negative, it can be purged. I think, like so many other things, even consciousness, you know, it's a commodity. It's real. You can finger it. You can touch it. We know now, because of the work done by people like Robert John at Princeton University and at the Monroe Institute in Virginia, and I'm quite sure you can come up with a number of other amazing, you know, academic facility institutions, where we now know that consciousness is not just a matter of firing synapses in the brain. It's not just related to tissue. It's outside of that.
Now,
is consciousness thought? Is it soul? Is it spirit? Is it all of that? I think it's a bit of all of that, and I don't think we fully understand it, but it is so. It does exist. It's outside of that. And therefore, we can manipulate it. We can access it.
Absolutely. I'm absolutely with you on that.
That's what happened. I mean, there's no question in my mind.
To move to a different topic, but it all relates. I don't know if you know, I published a book recently called Escaping from Eden. And the subtitle is, does Genesis teach that the human race was created by God or engineered by ETs? Now, I know that you're part of a little group called the Galactics, and you talk about questions like that. And so I wonder, in your group of Galactics, what your thoughts are on that question and in all the amazing things that you've seen, shamanic and otherwise, through your career,
Yeah.
How would you speak to that question? What are your thoughts?
You know, I have to tell you that there are more people who think I'm crazy than I can even begin to name, including every member of my family. they really do. I go to a number of conferences, and we're very fortunate here in LA because once every year in Palm Springs, there is an event called Contact in the Desert, which is an extraordinary event to go to because you have all of these paradigms being examined, extraterrestrials, yes, alternative healing, the paranormal, looking at alternative histories, on and on and on. It's an amazing place to go because you meet fascinating people. As I have, I've been there many years, but of course this year it didn't take place last year.
It's online this year.
It's online, but it's not the same thing. When you sit in the room and when you can meet and talk personally to someone like Erich von Däniken, you know, Chariots of the Gods guy, you know, and others like that, and Graham Hancock and on and on and on. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful because you can sit and just shoot the breeze with these amazing minds. It's wonderful. In answer to your question, I was a supervising producer for a series called Mysteries of the Bible for 4 years. And we looked at biblical texts and, you know, after having done a number of stories of the Bible, one day we were having a story conference and I said to the executive producer here at the studio here in LA, the production company was based in Washington, D.C., in Virginia. I think it was either the Arts and Entertainment Network or the History Channel, one of those. We're having a story conference. You know, what should the next season's shows be about? And my suggestion was, why don't we do one? Because we've been doing all these biblical stories from the Old Testament and the New Testament. Why don't we do a show about who wrote the Bible? Who wrote all this stuff down? Where did these books come from? How was the Bible compiled? Who was responsible for putting all this information together? Mm-hmm. And they said, yeah, great idea. And, you know, who's going to write it? And I said, I'd like to write that one myself because I'm particularly interested in the topic. And so I went away, and after less than a week later, I went back to the executive producer in the studio, and I said, I'm sorry, but you know, there's no way that I can do justice to the subject in 1 hour. Do you think the network will give us a second hour, another hour? You know, and that's being very audacious because that's breaking the rules. You can't do that. It's a fixed series, you know, and you just don't do things like that. And he looked at me and he said, well, because of the nature of the topic, maybe they will. I'll ask. And they said, yes. So I went away to do some more homework. It didn't take long before I went back again with a tail between my legs. And I said, 2 hours won't do it either. Can we get another hour? I thought he was going to fire me, but he didn't. And guess what? The network said, okay, sounds like a good idea. We'll do it as a Sunday afternoon special outside of the main series. We'll do a special called Who Wrote the Bible? 3 hours. So I went away and I wrote this. And, first hour is the first 5 books of the Bible. The second hour is the Old Testament. And the third hour is the New Testament. Looking at some of the authorship and where some of the sources came from, where do these books come from? So it was an absolutely fascinating experience for me. Surrounded by research, I had a great team of researchers, met extraordinary people. And I will tell you that I have no doubt in my mind whatsoever that the books, the first 5, particularly Genesis, the first book of the Bible, Genesis, we're talking about something that defies our normal understanding. You know, it's full of what I regard as clear examples of extraterrestrial encounters.
Definitely.
I would even go so far as saying that, you know, if the story of Moses receiving the Ten Commandments actually happened, and by the way, there's not a shred of evidence that it did happen, but that aside, and if he did ascend unto a mountain called, you know, Zion, called Sinai, and did encounter this being in the flames and was given these Ten Commandments, I believe that that might well have also have been an extraterrestrial encounter, a code of conduct, if you like. It wasn't just from some Holy Spirit. I really do think so. But when you look at the creation stories, the Hebrew word for man, Adam, is Adam. And Adam means earth. Adam means earth. Okay?
So he's an earthling.
The Bible very clearly gives the Genesis gives the series of events very, very clearly as to what happened first. There was the Big Bang, there was the firmament, then comes the earth, then comes this, then comes that, then comes the creatures of the sea, then comes the creatures of the land, then comes humans. It's all in the right order, evolutionary-wise, of how it really happened. But what are we actually talking about here? Mm-hmm. And when you look at some of these stories of the creation myths and all the rest of it, I mean, we're looking at ancient Sumerian texts. We're looking at stuff that is, you can clear as clear as a bell for those who can read those ancient texts from Sumeria, that part of the world. It's the same story. And even if you look at the story of Noah and the Ark, that's the Epic of Gilgamesh. There is so much similarity, and I think that what's really happened, and let me just stop for one moment and go off on a little tangent, because I must. In 1970, I did a documentary about Raymond Dart. Raymond Dart was an Australian, by the way, who was working in South Africa as a professor of anatomy in Johannesburg. And he developed an interest in early hominid fossils because he was the first guy to describe an Australopithecus Africanus fossil, one of the first hominid fossils found in Africa. The skull was found, the brain case was found, and then the jaw was found. The cranium was found, and then the mandible was found, and they fitted together perfectly, and it looked kind of like an ape, but it wasn't. The brain case was larger than an ape, but the teeth were human-like. And he said, my word, we're looking for an extinct creature that is more human-like than ape. And so he started this research. He was the first guy to do this. And I wanted to do a film about him because he was the guy who actually came up with the idea that humans started to use implements to get their prey millions of years ago. And in order to do that, they had to develop stone implements, you know, axes and whatever else. So it was a fascinating documentary. But one day, driving back from one of the locations, the place was called Makapan's Chat in the northern part of the country. And I said to him, Prof, you know, you've written a book about your first discovery, which was in 1924, and you called it Adventures with the Missing Link. I said to him, do you think we're ever going to find all the links in that chain, in that missing link? And he said, I don't think so. He said, there are too many other elements at stake. I don't think that we will ever find all those components because there have to be other things at play. He himself, this great anthropologist, you know, world-respected, said to me, there's more to this than we think. And I think he's absolutely right. I honestly believe that we encountered a long, long time ago. How long ago? Who knows? Millions of years? Hundreds of thousands of years? I think, and how much of our DNA do we understand? We don't. For a long, long time, they were saying, oh, that's junk DNA. That's junk DNA. Throw that away. We don't need that. I think we've been tweaked. I think we've been bioengineered.
Yes.
I think we have been bioengineered by encounters with species from other worlds. By the way, I don't think they've all been benevolent, and I don't think they've all been as nice as we would like them to be. Some of them may not be, because there have to be so many out there. We're certainly not alone. There must be millions of species out there. As we know now, I mean, the size of the universe, and as we know, how many extra exoplanets are there just in this in our neighborhood? 4,000 already, you know,
exactly. And counting. Well, Lionel, you and I are absolutely singing from the same hymn sheet. my beliefs are the same. And for me as well, my way into this topic of our paleo contact, bioengineering by other cosmic neighbors, I reached that territory through studying the Bible and going back and saying, oh, wait a minute, what's the etymology of that word that we translate this way?
Right,
what's the etymology of, what do the words actually mean? And this picture that you just painted for us, that is the picture that emerges, the Sumerian story and the story of our being tweaked, as you say, by others who have helped us along the way. And I've found not only in the Bible, but in ancestral narratives all around the world, there are memories that different cultures have curated of these interventions. Yeah. And I wonder, in your journey with African shamanism, do you find any memories of those interventions in the shamanic traditions and stories?
No, I have not, but Krita Mutwa speaks to a very, very great extent about that in his writings. He really does.
Yes.
Often. But I'm quite sure that in Australia, you know, with the Aboriginal people, there must be so many examples, again, of what we're talking about. As there are here in North America, the same thing with the Indigenous people from here. The same forgetting. Yes.
They have stories about the Star People, and yes. They have stories about Star People nurturing our life, the life of our ancestors.
Absolutely.
Something that really intrigues me. So coming back to your book, Forever in My Veins, it's a very intriguing title. Tell us how you came to that title, how we can get your book, and how we can keep up with what you're doing.
The title refers essentially to the fact that even though I'm a white Caucasian guy now living in California, I regard myself as an African. I was born there, and I discovered and experienced the absolutely amazing wonders and mysteries of that continent. They have never left me for a moment. I've made lots of films. I've met extraordinary people. I've experienced their cultures, their spiritual beliefs. Africa is an extraordinary continent. It's absolutely fascinating. And it's in my blood. It's in my veins. It always will be. I am essentially an African. People say to me here, you know, what are you originally? And I say, I'm an African-American, and they laugh. But I am. I am. So the Wonderful. Forever in My Veins means that, and the subtitle, if you like, of the next level down is that film is a drive also in my life. It's always been in my life ever since I was a child. Bless my mother's soul. She dragged me to the cinema when I was 5 years old, and I started making movies when I was 11, and I haven't stopped ever since. So that's also in my veins, and I've been able to combine those two elements. And you know, the other thing about what the title really means is that a sense of mystique and mystery and wonder will always course through my veins, that there is always so much more to know and learn. We live in an amazing cosmos, universe, world, planet, call it whatever you like. And it's a driver. It drives. I mean, we're on a cosmic journey. And how neat is that? And that pulses through my veins as well, you know.
Wonderful. And it's very obvious. Your passion and energy are absolutely extraordinary. Is it? Can I say how old you are?
I'm 76 now.
76. And you had this energy and enthusiasm and passion that is bouncing off the walls. And I think you are a great advert for all the insights that your book carries and all the stories that you've curated for us. Where can we get your book?
Thank you for saying that, Paul. I do appreciate it. The book is available now on Amazon.com, all the Amazon sites around the world. Here in the States, it's also available on Barnes & Noble. And the major bookstores, those that are open with this pandemic, will carry it as from next week. But it's available now on Amazon.com.
Great. It's called
Forever in My Veins, and the subtitle is, you know, how film led me to all these amazing adventures. And I'd love people to derive their own adventure story out of that, because we all can. You know, there really is so much more to every single one of us. And I just wanted to be the prod to get everyone to feel the same way as I do.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Lionel. It's been an absolute pleasure talking with you today. We could talk forever, but we'll pause there, and I hope we'll talk again another day. But thank you so much for being with us today on The Fifth Kind TV.
Thank you, Paul. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Take care.
The Fifth Kind. Check out our official website at fifthkind.tv.